Hi, everyone. Welcome back. Today, we are with a couple of our Georgia state attorneys. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
So why don't you go ahead and start with your name and then what area of law you practice?
I'm Catherine Bernard. I'm a Georgia attorney and I focus on criminal defense, but I also get involved in some political and election cases, which of course has overlapped with criminal defense a lot lately.
Mm-hmm. And what about you?
Oh, so I'm Alex Johnson. I do a lot of constitutional rights litigation, suing the government when they violate people's rights. I also do some injury cases, helping people against insurance companies, and represent some businesses. So I handle the civil side of the firm.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay, we were just talking about this off camera, but I asked you a question that a lot of times we hear that people cannot sue the government. So is that true? And what cases have you seen people win against the government in?
So you can sue the government a lot of times. It's under something called 1983. It's the federal civil rights statute. And you can sue government officials for violating people's rights by not letting them speak at a meeting where they're supposed to be able to speak. Content-based restrictions you can win lawsuits on. One of the cases I first handled was a case regarding an inmate who got pressure washed while in custody by the guards, and it was all on camera. Or if you get arrested for literally no reason, things like that you could sue government officials for. So if their constitutional rights are violated, you could sue them. Although I will say that it's oftentimes a coin flip because of qualified immunity and sovereign immunity. There's a lot of ways government officials can get out of
interesting
lawsuit.
Interesting. Let's go ahead and talk a little bit about the right to free speech versus obscenity.
Yeah. So the right to free speech, it's interesting because right now there's a lot of talk about school boards and library boards limiting what can be in a library. Mm-hmm. And it's unconstitutional to essentially discriminate based on content. But there's also case law that says that you don't need to allow all material. You don't need to have obscene material in front of children. And it's a tough battle because a lot of people are afraid of having any limitations. Mm-hmm. And I do wonder if that's something where it'd be very useful to replace some of the bureaucrats in various entities because they're the ones making these calls.
Mm-hmm. Let's dig into a little bit about what's happening with Trump's prosecutions in Georgia.
Well, and this is an example of how the political process has intersected with the criminal defense world. You know, President Trump has been facing cases all around the country. And then most recently in Georgia, he and 18 other folks were indicted in a RICO case, mm-hmm. which is racketeering-inspired corrupt organizations. And so it is alleging that President Trump led a conspiracy to overturn the election and took actions in Georgia based on that. The client that I'm representing, Jeffrey Clark, was a Department of Justice official who did nothing more than draft a letter that was circulated within the Department of Justice talking about significant concerns with Georgia elections. And this was based on things like the Ligon report that came out of the Georgia Senate, which contained testimony from individuals around Georgia about irregularities that they had seen in their local elections. And so that letter has formed the basis for an attempted false statements charge. So it's a pretty wild world where Department of Justice officials talking to each other about proposed plans can somehow constitute a crime in an entirely different state.
Mm-hmm. I've heard people talk, if you could go into detail about this, that it's getting into very dangerous waters when past presidents are entering the legal system.
It definitely is, but I will note we've been in dangerous waters for some time, you know, looking back to 2001 and the Patriot Act and the way that it limited a lot of our rights and gave the government additional powers.
What is the Patriot Act?
The Patriot Act was passed in 2001 in response to September, the attacks on the mm-hmm. Twin Towers and the Pentagon. And basically it expanded government's powers of surveillance pretty extensively. And it also came along with something called the National Defense Authorization Act, which actually provided for indefinite detention of American citizens, which is unconstitutional, of course. And it was passed in a climate of fear and concern for safety, which is often where our liberties are most at risk. But that's when we got the Department of Homeland Security, the Transportation Security Administration, which, you know, those did not exist in the previous century. Those are massive expansions of government power. And so we're really coming to this current prosecution of President Trump and others mm-hmm. in a world where prosecutors have a lot of power, and we've been giving it to them for the past decades. So yes, it is very dangerous territory, but there have been warning signs that, frankly, both Republicans and Democrats have ignored as they have given more power to government in Congress after Congress.
Mm-hmm. Can Trump run for the presidency from jail?
Yes.
Can he, if he were to be elected, could he run the country from jail?
That's an interesting question, and really does take us into new territory. Maybe so. You know, the White House does not have any legal status as the place that the president has to operate from, and it is really the authority of the American people that grants the president the power to act that he has. Mm-hmm. And so I would think the argument would be that if individuals choose to elect a president, then that president can operate from wherever that president is.
But the real question is, would he be able to pardon himself?
That is a very interesting question, and I don't have an answer on that. I would say arguably yes.
Interesting. Very, very interesting. What is your professional opinion on what you see happening over the course of these legal cases and presidency ramping up?
Well, I see it as the basically we are turning the political process into a fight between two sides, mm-hmm. where it's no longer about a constitutional republic where we're all sort of participating in it as individuals. People are sort of picking a team. And, you know, when my team is in power, then I want the government to have a lot of control. Mm-hmm. But when my team is out of power, then I want to talk about how we resist power and how that's the American way. If you remember from 2016 to 2020, there was a lot of talk about resistance and standing up to government. And then when President Biden came into office, now there's much more of a, oh, it's domestic terrorism to criticize anything that the government mm-hmm. is doing. And so I think that that partisanship, unfortunately, is driving our criminal justice system in some pretty dangerous ways.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the ways that you're seeing our constitutional rights be abused?
So there's a lot of times government officials are just ignoring ignoring the law. I mean, you see it right now with the prosecutions that we're just talking about, that is something where you would think that you would be presumed innocent and have rights to fair trials, but instead it's been politicized. You see a lot of times the individual officers in some of these areas, like when people get arrested for no reason, you do end up seeing a politicization of rights abuses when it shouldn't be there. I mean, I think everybody agrees you shouldn't be charged with a crime for no reason. You shouldn't be charged with a crime as
no matter your party, no matter your affiliation, you mm-hmm. should not be charged with a crime if you haven't done anything
yeah,
wrong.
Yeah, you shouldn't be charged with a crime if you haven't done anything wrong. You shouldn't be charged with a crime for political reasons. Mm-hmm. Like, these are things that used to be sort of bedrocks of our society, but now it seems as if whenever something happens, when there's somebody being a prosecutor or a government official being accused of misconduct, it just breaks down party lines one way or the other. And it's very dangerous because the politicians themselves don't seem to be doing much to fix the problems. I mean, you know, a few years ago, you had all those protests regarding George Floyd, but they were Democrat cities. Democrats are running the cities. They were running the police departments. No one called for them, and they didn't do anything to allegedly fix the problems. All they did mm-hmm. was they riled up people in order to try to get votes, which is a sad thing that they don't really care. They just... Mm-hmm. They just want to get votes. So I think that's what we're seeing.
I was recently in Minnesota and we drove through the town and I was very surprised by how it's a dead town. like where the George Floyd riots happened and his death. And, you know, and so it was like, you know, Minnesota, the city was such a beautiful city. And so it was like driving through there, it was just, it had this eerie quietness in the city. It was very interesting.
Well, as somebody who's been following rights violations for some time, it has been interesting to watch the oscillation. I feel like in George Floyd's case, we really had a moment where the country was coming together to say, hey, we don't want to see anybody killed on the street by people in uniform. You know, that's not the way that we want our city to operate. We want our country to operate. But unfortunately, you know, it was an election year, and I think you saw some pushing of some very destructive protests, you know, protests that certainly crossed the line from peaceful into destructive. And I think that reduced the sympathy that was building up for, you know, opposition to the police state. And frankly, that is, we do have a police state. It's been building up for some time. And just at various points, Republicans and Democrats have seen it as, well, it's my police state that I can use against my enemy. And the way government power works is it's like a ratchet, you know, it just goes more and more power, and whatever power you take to use against your enemies can then be used against you later on.
Mm-hmm. We here at headquarters know how important attorneys are in local politics. From your perspective, how important are you guys in affecting local change?
I mean, I think it's important that attorneys get involved, because a lot of times you have a lot of in the political sphere, mm-hmm. you see a lot of attorneys getting paid by government officials, getting paid by county commissions, and pretty much they sit there and advise bigger government, more control, mm-hmm. and less accountability to the citizens. And I think that what we really need is more people who are legally trained getting involved for the right reasons, for getting involved for the same reason that CDF exists, and really advocating for and pushing more individual freedom, more individual rights, and just educating people on how they can stand up to oppression and show the elected officials how they can change the laws to create a better society instead of more controls.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I think about when you say that attorneys can get paid from elected officials, how is that legal?
Well, they get hired for county commissions and city commissions, like city councils, mm-hmm. and by county commissions. And then a lot of times the people that are running around saying, like, vote for me for county commissioner, vote for me for city council, they run as if they're leaders. Then they get elected. And then the first thing they do is they turn to either city managers, county managers, or the city attorney or county attorney, and then say, what do I do now? Mm-hmm. They aren't actually leaders. They just defer to these bureaucrats, and that's bureaucratic lawyers or bureaucratic managers, who their only goal is to expand government, maintain control, and then use that to move on to the next stepping stone in their careers. And that's really, looping back to involvement in politics, that's where a lot of it comes down to, is that charitable attorneys, mm-hmm. and people that are there for altruism, you're going to end up having these bureaucrats run everything.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a surprise for a lot of folks when they go to their local school board or their election board and they think, these are the decision makers, these are the people I'm talking to, these are the people I have an opportunity to vote for. But those people say, well, I'd love to help you out, but, you know, our attorney tells me we can't do that. We hear that over and over mm-hmm. again. And you know, certainly giving a legal opinion and advice is fine, but these are the elected officials who are responsible for making legislation. To have them passing the buck to these unelected bureaucrats who often have their own set of incentives and influences and are not directly accountable to the citizenry, I think that's where we see a lot of the disconnect between the policy outcomes that we're seeing and people's dissatisfaction with them. It's mm-hmm. because that decision-making is getting filtered through government-paid attorneys rather than elected officials.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is that just about everything that anyone ever complains about regarding a government official doing something wrong, there's a politician responsible for it. The politicians won't admit to it, but they are the ones who are responsible for it, and then they'll turn around and say all day, every day, I'm doing this because some bureaucrat told me to do it. They'll say the city manager, they'll say an attorney, they'll say a county manager, they'll say somebody, but that politician who has ultimate decision-making power over money or government policy, they will say it's somebody else's problem. They will pass the buck and say it in a way that makes most people think, oh, I should be sympathetic to this guy or gal. But that guy or gal is the one that's responsible for it. I mean, looping back to what we said a minute ago regarding like the George Floyd protests, every police department is run by an elected official. But you didn't see people going against the elected officials. You saw the elected officials blaming the cops. And it's like, wait a second, the elected officials run the cops. So you should be protesting the elected officials, not the person they ordered around or set policies to do whatever you think was wrong.
Mm-hmm. We had a sheriff tell our organization once that at the end of the day, he is a politician too.
That's a great quote and very honest. I will say, so sheriffs are the highest constitutional officers in their state. Arguably, a sheriff could arrest the president if the president violated some law in their county. But again, these sheriffs, you know, they will try to say, oh, no, I'm controlled. You know, I have to follow what the state says. I have to follow what the federal government says. Mm-hmm. But that's not the way our system of government is structured. We're supposed to have power devolving to the local level and then being delegated upwards.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, and there's a big example of this going on in Georgia with the Trump prosecution. Just last year, the Georgia legislature created a prosecuting attorney's commission to review their actions and decide whether the district attorneys were behaving correctly. And now district attorneys are elected in Georgia. They're appointed in some other places, but you know, they're elected directly by the people. And there is a provision in the Georgia Constitution where district attorneys, like any other official, can be impeached by a two-thirds vote of the legislature. But the legislature delegated that power and they pretended, oh, look, we're doing something to increase accountability. What they were doing was creating an unelected board of their friends who were prosecutors and retired judges, etc., that then they can say, oh, well, it's their responsibility to make a decision about this bad DA, rather than taking that responsibility onto themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And they're doing that right now. That is exactly what they're doing, because one of my friends, State Senator Colton Moore in Georgia, actually said, hey, we need to defund Fani Willis's office, the Fulton County DA, who's doing this political prosecution, and potentially investigate her for potential impeachment. State senators saying, we need to do this. And you would figure in a Republican state, the Republican elected officials would get on board. And after they were, I guess, surprised by the call to do that, they then proceeded to attack Colton, saying he was just trying to get attention, and then said, we have this commission. Focus on this commission. The commission hasn't even started operating yet. And there's this lawsuit saying it's unconstitutional because of that delegation of authority away from the state legislature. But they're like, oh no, just trust that in a few months. We need to do nothing and ignore this call to defund or investigate and for us to do our duty. So pretty much 98% of the Georgia legislature used what Catherine was just talking about to deflect responsibility away from themselves of investigating and impeaching somebody, and said, oh no, just go to this commission instead.
Mm-hmm. You brought up a district attorney. Could you give us, could you explain to us how important a district attorney is?
District attorneys are insanely important. They are the ones who choose who gets prosecuted and for
now
what.
I'm going to interrupt you for just a moment.
Indictments.
Because as a practical matter, you're not wrong, but legally that's not the way it should be. The grand jury, which it consists of members of the county who are upright and of good character, they are supposed to be the ones passing judgment on whether or not someone gets indicted. And this goes all the way back to the Magna Carta in 1215, when a bunch of Englishmen got together and said, all right, King John, you know, you cannot take anybody to trial unless we agree that there is probable cause that they have done something wrong. But as a practical matter, people who serve on grand juries don't necessarily recognize their own power. And you have a district attorney who presents them with an indictment that they vote on, but they don't know that they've absolutely got the power to say no, or, well, maybe bring me some more evidence, or I'd like to hear from this witness. So while district attorneys, as a practical matter, do have the authority over charging decisions, that's really kind of an example of the same trend we've talked about, how government has just collected more and more power for itself at the expense of the organs that citizens should be able to use to hold it accountable. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And they can choose to not prosecute people. And that's something that creates issues when you're saying, oh, well, we aren't going to prosecute thieves. But I mean, you go back far enough. I mean, you go back to alcohol prohibition or the Fugitive Slave Act, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, if you have a good, good people working as prosecutors in government, they may not prosecute people mm-hmm. who are just trying to be free. And that's where it's a balance, but they're very important positions. And I think it's why a lot of the left has tried to put people into those positions that mm-hmm. will do things like prosecute political opponents.
What's the process like in a county when a crime is committed?
That'd be the criminal.
So first of all, someone will have to report the crime. And so law enforcement is usually involved at first. And if there is an individual that is, suspected of committing a crime, in Georgia, a private citizen can apply for a warrant against someone. They can say to the magistrate judge, hey, I believe I'm the victim of a crime. I need to have a hearing on whether an arrest warrant can be issued. A police officer doesn't have to have that special hearing with notice. They can just do a warrantless arrest on someone or write out a warrant, swear to it before a magistrate judge, and take that person into custody. At that point, a judge has the authority to decide whether or not that person can be released on bond or not, or whether they have to stay in jail just based on the fact that they've been charged. Then the next stage is an accusation or an indictment. That's the formal charging instrument. And that's what actually starts the process of going to court. You have to enter a plea of guilty or not guilty. And if you enter a plea of not guilty, you can demand all of the evidence that the state has against you and file motions, argue your innocence, ultimately get to a jury trial where you can make your case to the people of the community that you are not guilty of the crime that you've been accused of. Of course, there's also a lot of plea bargaining that goes on mm-hmm. because, some people who are arrested for crimes actually are guilty of crimes, and there may be negotiation between the district attorney's office and that person and their lawyer about, well, if you agree to plead guilty, will you accept 5 years on probation or 10 years in prison, depending on what the crime is.
Mm-hmm. Do attorneys ever have, is there any pressure coming down for attorneys to get plea deals?
Yes.
Or to plead guilty or a confession?
Yes. And the pressure comes from so many different angles. I mean, one of them is the financial incentives of the lawyers involved. The state has a whole team of lawyers that are paid with tax money. They have investigators that are paid with tax money. They have access to all of the agencies of the state, which are also paid with tax money. The defendant might have access to a public defender's office or has to hire their own attorney and pay all of those costs for themselves. So there is a pretty significant asymmetry in terms of the aggressiveness with which you can pursue a complicated case. So sometimes people are pressured into pleading just because they don't have the resources to fight the case effectively. And frankly, often lawyers' schedules, they're being pushed mm-hmm. into a bunch of different courts, and it's a lot easier to just go ahead and get someone pled out than go through showing up for court multiple times on multiple calendars just to get the chance to go to a jury trial.
And there's the fact that a lot of times people don't realize that police can lie to you. Like they can read you your rights, which are honest, your Miranda rights, and then they turn around and they say, we have all the evidence on you. We know that you did this crime. So what are you going to do? And there have been cases that are publicized where people falsely confess because they just figure, well, if the government says that they have evidence to prove that I committed this horrible crime, I should just tell them I did it because they're implying that it'll be better for me if I do. And that is notorious, and it happens regularly because police, government officials and police can lie to you. There is no prohibition on them lying to you. Although if you lie to them, as I think it was with General Flynn, they'll charge you with obstruction and it's a felony, and they'll leverage that to try to get whatever else they want. So it it regularly happens that police will lie to you, but you aren't allowed to lie to them. So essentially, just never talk to government officials. That is the best advice. Like, do not talk to them, especially without an attorney. I mean, get an attorney if you feel any pressure mm-hmm. to talk to them. But that also makes it hard to have civil rights claims, because if you plead guilty, you no longer have the ability to sue for false arrest, even if the plea deal is, like, I get to walk free and my record's clear. Mm-hmm. If you take a plea, you can't hold them accountable.
And I want to emphasize the structural incentives are very similar with, you know, the good folks who are out there at their school boards mm-hmm. and election boards with CDF and other organizations. You know, those are people who are having to take time off work, time away from their families, time away from their other obligations just to participate in their own government. And the people they're dealing with, again, are being paid with their taxpayer money. So there's a big resource asymmetry there that can be a real challenge. And so that's why it's great to have organizations like CDF bringing like-minded people mm-hmm. together for the cause of limited government, truth, accountability, justice, all that good stuff that we used to call the American way.
Mm-hmm. You touched on this a little bit earlier, but could you elaborate on the police state?
The police have a tremendous amount of power, and frankly, I didn't realize it growing up. You know, I grew up in a small college town in Virginia and was fortunate to not have any contact with law enforcement. But especially when I became a public defender in rural Georgia, I realized that there are entire communities where the police are, you know, routinely doing very aggressive patrols. And now there are some areas that can be high crime areas where people are asking for police patrols. So I certainly don't mean to imply that a police presence can never be a good thing. But what I encountered were police presences that were intimidating, threatening, that were, you know, going after particularly young men and making them feel like they had done something wrong. Kind of like the stop and frisk approach that was taken in New York City, where, you know, young men, particularly, you know, Black and Hispanic young men, were just being stopped, you know, empty your pockets, tell us what you've got. And now that's not a situation that causes people to have respect for government and the police. That causes people to think, well, if they're going to treat me like a criminal, no matter what I do, then what's the incentive for me not to be a criminal? And so this very, and what I've realized, especially working with a civil rights lawyer, is that police get away with this quite frequently because these people don't have the resources to sue about it, or they might not have damages that are sufficient to make a case worthwhile. But it's all legal. It's happening under color of law. So it has been very concerning to me as a public defender to see the power that police have even over innocent people's lives. And it's also worth noting that it has come along with a militarization of the police. You know, if you look at Andy Griffith, you know, decades ago, you have the police officer as a peace officer, you know, somebody there to keep the peace and make sure that innocent people aren't getting hurt, you know, go after somebody if they are hurting somebody. I think that's a vision of police that we can all get behind. But especially with the military-industrial complex has really ended up sending a lot of military equipment to local police forces around the country. And that has resulted in an increase in SWAT-style raids. One of the very first cases I saw when I became a public defender was a drug raid. You know, there was an allegation that somebody might have some marijuana in their house. And the police ended up shooting a woman in the arm while she was holding her baby cowering in a closet. I mean, just, and there's stories like that all over the place. You know, she survived. Many people don't in that situation. And so that was really very eye-opening to me as someone who had not personally experienced that kind of, you know, frankly, oppressive authoritarian treatment, that it has become normalized in so many places around the country.
And I think a lot of it is the rise, like the police state is directly correlated to the rise of the idea of society as a victim. Because you see it in two major aspects. I mean, it used to be very much solely limited to the drug wars, like where the police go, because you asked earlier, how does a criminal prosecution happen? Sometimes it happens with the police finding somebody, sending them to buy drugs somewhere, and then raiding a house seizing the person's mm-hmm. property and then saying, well, if you want the property back, you need to sue us, even if you're innocent of any crimes, because that's civil asset forfeiture, and that happens in numerous states. I think the feds still may still do it. But the whole basis of that, though, is not that you are a victim of a crime or I'm a victim of a crime. It's the idea that, well, society is the victim. We had a trial recently where a police officer actually said, well, the state of Georgia is the victim. We have no victim listed here on the report except the state of Georgia. And you take that system where the government is saying, well, we're making ourselves a victim and going after you. Fast forward to now. Who's the victim in these Trump prosecutions? They're claiming it's society. I mean, you don't see anybody personally being hurt here. Like, it's just like, oh yeah, I mean, he was trying to like steal an election. Like, who thinks that? Who's sitting there being victimized by the past president? Like, no one. I mean, we all saw the political machinations by the Democrats. We saw that going on, and now right before the election, they're charging President Trump with crimes. I mean, there is no victim there, but the government has started to say that they are speaking for all of us, even when they're not speaking for any of us. There is no victim. I mean, if you rob somebody, the person who's robbed is a victim. Somebody gets assaulted, that person is a victim. Those are crimes that should be prosecuted, but this police state is the government creating crimes for its own political purposes, or in the case of forfeitures, to fund themselves. And that's where I think the police, the impact of the police state really is. And it's really concerning.
How can citizens learn more of their rights in these certain types of situations?
That's a great question. And we and other organizations we've been involved in have done Know Your Rights trainings. And actually, one of the groups that I did Know Your Rights training with was kind of a leftist group that was very involved in the BLM protests, you know, in the summer of 2020. But they leaned more on the anarchy side versus the left side. And so they really believed in, you know, here's what you should do if an officer comes to your door and says, you know, I'd like to come in and look around. No, thank you. I don't give consent to any searches. So these kinds of community trainings can be very useful. And, you know, groups that I think are probably affiliated with CDF around the country do some of those. Probably we need to do some more of them. But really, getting engaged with your local officials is important as well, because like the sheriff who said, you know, I'm a politician. Well, then I'm a voter and I've got some mm-hmm. opinions on the way you're conducting business. And why do you really need that MRAP device for, you know, driving around a quiet little town in South Georgia? They've got these big tanks and, you know, other things that it's like, is this really what a peace officer would be doing?
And I think when it comes to like the question of how do people know their rights? Mm-hmm. Like, how do you let people know their rights? I mean, I think a good bit of it is you need the accountability of politicians on the front end to make sure that they don't pass laws and policies that violate people's rights. On the back end, the way that people need to know their rights is to think about the idea of just say no. I mean, just say no to government officials being treated as you know, people that are over us. I mean, government officials work for us. Mm-hmm. And the idea that if one of them comes to your home and asks you questions or wants to look around, or if one's thinking of prosecuting you and says, hey, come speak to us at the station, or come speak to a grand jury, the answer is no. Talk to my attorney. Get an attorney, or just say no, because the government can't compel you to do things. I mean, unless they're going to arrest you, you can just say no. And if they're asking the question, may I search your car? May I come into your house? Will you come talk to me? I mean, I keep thinking back to, I think it was General Flynn who got charged with obstruction for some slight inconsistency in what he told FBI agents. Why did a general talk to the FBI? I sort of thought he should know better. I mean, don't talk to people mm-hmm. that are trying to investigate you.
Right. You're not going to talk yourself out of it.
Exactly.
Well, and again, I think certainly with the January 6th prosecutions and the conduct that we've seen from the FBI involved in that, it's really validated a lot of what people in the criminal defense community have been seeing for years and years, that these government officials just have almost unlimited authority to pursue people for really anything they want.
Mm-hmm. Is there any concern amongst attorneys for being disbarred over getting into these waters of defending conservatives?
I don't know that I would have said yes to this 5 years ago, but I'm certainly saying yes today. Jeff Clark, for example, has been facing proceedings in Washington, D.C. for almost 2 years where they've been trying to take his bar license over this draft letter that he wrote. And even attorneys who have represented him have been the subject of bar complaints. There's something called the 65 Project, which is funded by a number of Democrat donors, and really it pursues any lawyer who is participating in election challenges. They accuse that person of, you know, trying to steal elections and say you should have your bar license taken. Of the 19 people indicted in the Fulton County RICO case, 8 were attorneys. Attorneys who were providing legal advice and novel theories on how to conduct election challenges. And that really is, that is a dangerous place. We are really crossing the Rubicon there when we are saying that participating in legal challenges and putting forth constitutional theories can itself be a crime.
Mm-hmm. And I would say that the concern is more of one regarding authoritarianism versus freedom with these bar associations. Mm-hmm. Because one thing that I've noticed in a lot of organizations, especially in government and local boards, is that the people who want to be on bar associations are more likely to be towards the authoritarian end of things. They want control. And when you look at the fact that DC Bar was targeting various attorneys for disbarment, you have to remember DC, I think, is 80 or 90% Democrat, but that doesn't necessarily give the whole picture. Democrats are more likely to be authoritarian, but there are plenty of authoritarian Republicans that want to use the government against citizens. And I think that the concern is there because of that shift. I mean, in Georgia, I know a decent number of the people in the bar. I don't think they're going to be going around trying to disbar attorneys, but they might. Not because it's a Democrat state, because Georgia is not, but because the people that get drawn into the bar associations are more likely to say, well, I have this power, maybe I should use it. And it's like, well, shouldn't people be free to represent the clients that they're choosing? Isn't that part of the mm-hmm. basis of our country, that we have a free judiciary and attorneys are free to represent people and citizens are free to have the attorney of their choice? Mm-hmm. And I think that that's, it varies by state, but I do agree that there is a concern that as we move more towards authoritarian government, they'll be targeting attorneys more that aren't willing to just sit back and let there be kangaroo courts.
I mean, mm-hmm. I did have a prosecutor threaten me once when I had gone up to the legislature to they were trying to pass a bill that would have significantly restricted Fourth Amendment rights and basically given the police grounds to search if they thought a crime was about to be committed, which is, you know, sort of a pre-crime kind of attitude towards things. And I had gone up and spoken against it. And this prosecutor said, you know, well, if Ms. Bernard is not fulfilling her duties to her clients because she's, you know, up at the legislature, maybe she needs a bar complaint. And I will say the judge did yell at him for that. But, you know, this kind of bullying and threatening is kind of part of the way that mm-hmm. the members of the government will sometimes conduct business, because in fact, in Columbus, Georgia, the prosecutor just recently made a motion to keep a defense attorney from making facial expressions towards the jury because they were considered too prejudicial. And yes, the defense attorney asked, do you want me to be bound and gagged? And the judge said, are you asking for him to be bound and gagged? The prosecutor did at least say no to that. So this kind of thing is happening in courtrooms. Mm-hmm. And certainly when people have come to court with me, they have thought, you know, Catherine, I really thought you might have been exaggerating. You know, some of these stories, they just seem like too alien to what I know my country to be. But then when you sit there in a court and, you know, watch these, you know, dozens and hundreds of people just get filtered through, you know, 1 in 3 Americans has been arrested. At this point, we are at a very scary number of the number of people who have mm-hmm. had contact with the criminal justice system, and that's going in the wrong direction.
Mm-hmm. And when you mention talking to the legislature, that's something where it reminds me that one thing that government does abuse people in is that government will fund government to then lobby government to expand itself and increase its own power. I mean, I kid you not, because if people talk to their local sheriff, a lot of times just try it as an experiment. Ask your local sheriff like what they think about some law and say that you don't like the law. It could be anything. It could be something about speeding. It could be something about marijuana. It could be something about taxes. And just say, why are you enforcing this law? You'll almost certainly hear the response, I don't make the law, I enforce it. But then if you look at the money, you'll see that there's probably a sheriff's association or some other association that elected official is part of, that when there is a bill to change the law, they are lobbying in favor of whatever position it is that currently exists. I mean, I think in Florida recently, there was a move to try to push constitutional carry, and then some people were trying to add in open carry. And I believe that at least one sheriff's association was lobbying against more gun freedom in a Republican state. And that type of thing also happened in Georgia, and it happens elsewhere, where the politicians will say, I don't make the law. And then, well, the sheriffs say they won't make the law. Mm-hmm. And then it gets to the legislature and they're
lobbying.
Yeah, and they're getting paid by the government. So it's the lobbyists are funding themselves to do that.
Meanwhile, we have brave citizen lobbyists, you know, giving up, again, their own resources to go down to talk to the legislature. And they're up against these professional lobbyists who are funded with their own tax dollars arguing against them.
Mm-hmm. Well, in closing, what is encouraging that you're seeing now for conservatives?
I think there are more people seeing the scope of government control. You know, again, you know, the people who maybe they were in, you know, maybe they were concerned about, you know, the George Floyd situation, and maybe they were concerned about the protests, and then they see January 6th, and then they see people being arrested for protesting other things, like our clients who were arrested for protesting a trans queer Pride for Kids parade in Rome, Georgia. And so that's the silver lining of the government expanding this authoritarianism, is that more people are experiencing it personally or seeing it happen to themselves or a loved one. And they're waking up and realizing, hey, this isn't the way I want to live. I want to live in a world where we can all be free to pursue life the way we choose, not be controlled by some top-down collectivist bureaucracy that's going to make us all less free, safe, and happy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that what's encouraging is the fact the left is going too far. I think a lot of people are waking up. When you start messing with people's children and you start saying that children should be able to have like life-altering surgeries without the permission of their parents, when you start having openly political prosecutions and then for them to even follow up saying that the people being prosecuted shouldn't be able to criticize the people prosecuting them, like when you start seeing that in public, I think that a lot of people wake up and start realizing that it's gone too far. And I think that organizations like CDF and other political movements are very much growing in large numbers, and people are willing to now sacrifice their time to show up to the legislature, to show up to city council meetings, school board meetings, library meetings. It used to be it was only the paid people doing it, and now now the citizens are waking up. But
they are.
Yeah, I think the left going too far is actually a good thing for waking up conservatives, because we could, there are more of us than them.
Well, and I think there's a lot of people who, you know, however they identify politically, they are concerned about freedom, you know, freedom as a basic American right. You know, that was why we started this country. And so I think there are even people who are getting beyond the partisan divides on it and recognizing it as an issue of government authority versus human freedom. And they want to be on the side of human freedom.
Well, thank you guys both for all that you're doing on behalf of the citizens. And thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Lindsay. Thank you. This has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, thanks for having us on. This is awesome.